Hi, it's Mike Collins. WFAE is in the midst of our fall membership campaign. We're bringing you this podcast without fundraising breaks. But first, I do have a quick pitch before we get to the show. Everything we do at WFAE is paid for by our listeners. Consider supporting Charlotte Talks right now for $20 a month, and we'll send you a Public Radio Nerd t-shirt. Give online at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. And thank you for your support.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Most of us have heard or read a book recommendation that goes like this. Such and such an author writes history that reads like a novel. All too often, the true story of that true story reminds one of Mark Twain's definition of a classic, something that everybody wants to have read and nobody wants to read. Even so, a few nonfiction writers can and do meet those expectations, and one of them is my guest today, Karen Abbott, who writes books grounded in historical fact, but, spoiler alert, they're also legitimate keep-you-up-past-your-bedtime page-turners. Her new book, The Ghosts of Eden Park, tells the story of the King of the Bootleggers and the two very different women who pursued him for very different reasons. Karen Abbott, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, before we discuss the book, I should mention that Karen will be in Charlotte on November 7th as part of Verse and Vino, the Charlotte Mecklenburg Library Foundation's annual fundraiser, and you can get details about that at wfae.org/charlottetalks. One more piece of preliminary business. Is it true, Karen, that you prefer to be called Abbott, and if so, why?
Well, Abbott is actually my legal first name. It's a long story, but the short version is that one day about 2013, a reader wrote to me and said that if she Googled me, Google said I was dead. And sure enough, Google said I had died in 2010. Going through a situation at that time, I would think I was turning 40 around that time and decided, hey, I'm just going to change my name. So my legal first name is actually Abbott, but you can call me whatever you wish today. It's totally fine with me.
So you're speaking to us from the great beyond, which explains why Ghosts is part of your title, correct?
Exactly. I actually could interview my characters firsthand since they're all dead. So that was very handy.
So yeah, that is very handy. You're going to have quite the career. onto the matter at hand, you have said that you got the idea for this book watching HBO's Boardwalk Empire, which included your real-life bootlegger, a man named George Remus. And it also included a lightly fictionalized version of Mabel Walker Willebrandt, who was the assistant attorney general who pursued Remus back in the 20s. So I'm curious, how soon after you started looking into the actual history did you decide you had a book on your hands?
Well, when I was watching Boardwalk Empire, I was working on my last book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, about female Civil War spies. So I was in the thick of that, but I began keeping a file on George Remus and Mabel Walker Willebrandt. And at first, you know, I watched the show and I didn't even know that they were real characters. George Remus came on the screen and he was so innovative and so cuckoo and so brilliant. And he spoke of himself in the third person. You know, he would say things like Remus has the good stuff and Remus, you know, has the best liquor and Remus, everybody wants to kill Remus. And I thought, was he a real historical figure? And of course, I did some digging, and indeed, he was a real historical figure, and he was much more interesting than his real story was more interesting than anything they portrayed on Boardwalk Empire. And the more I sort of found his story and the connections with Mabel Willebrandt, the more I knew this was a fantastic story and one that was lent itself to a novel-esque narrative.
How familiar was this story? I mean, I had never heard of any of these people or the circumstances that you chronicle in this book. I'm wondering, how familiar is it to most people, or do you have a sense of that yet?
No, I think surprisingly, shockingly, Remus and Willebrandt were both lost to history. And I think part of the reason is because Remus was the biggest bootlegger in American history. He remains that. But he was also pretty much the first big bootlegger in American history. He began his empire early in 1920. By 1921, George Remus owned 35% of all the liquor in the United States.
Wow.
Just an astounding figure. And I think that, of course, his story went on, but Al Capone came up then, and I think that Remus's narrative got lost in the fact that this guy was leaving dead bodies all over Chicago. And so the narrative of the bootlegger turned from George Remus to Al Capone. And, you know, Remus built his empire with intelligence and scheming and sort of a very savvy business sense. And Capone just used violence. So I think Capone's story just rose to the forefront because of that.
Without giving away what happened to whom, there is a murder trial that is at the heart of this book. At the time, was it analogous to an OJ type trial, or how big of a story was it at the time?
Oh, it was a huge story. It made international headlines. And the really lucky thing for me in terms of writing this book was that the trial transcripts survived. Which is really rare to find historical trial transcripts. Usually they're just tossed out or people get lost or they're destroyed in a fire. But the trial transcript was full of fascinating details about all of the main players, including my favorite tidbit, which was that George Remus did not wear underwear. which apparently,
you mentioned that several times in the book.
Yes, it was a cause for great alarm in the 1920s. It was scandalous. It was possibly dangerous. And it was potentially the sign of an unsound mind if somebody didn't like to wear underwear. So just finding these really interesting and funny anachronisms is part of the joy of research. But the trial transcript was invaluable. It was 5,500 pages. It took me 4 months to go through the entire trial transcript and create an outline, and the outline was 85,000 words, which was almost the length of the book itself. So I had plenty of material to work with, and it was great fun.
And in terms of the book, what the finished book looks like and reads like, how much of that do you credit to that 5,500-page transcript?
Oh, there's a lot from there, mostly because dialogue is the thing that makes nonfiction read like fiction. If you can get a good amount of dialogue, it really moves the story along. And it was, of course, the nature of a trial is that people are getting up there and testifying and saying, well, I said this, then he responded this way. He was thinking this. I was thinking this. I was wearing this. This is where I moved to. And it sort of allows you to create those really cinematic scenes that other primary source material doesn't really give you that opportunity. So I relied on it quite a bit. And I also used excerpts from the trial transcript to I wanted to write a true crime thriller, a sort of a whodunit, a narrative nonfiction whodunit. And it was the trial transcripts that also let me do that, plant little clues. And at some point in the narrative, it becomes clear that any one of these people could kill the other one at any moment. So even the hired hitman was afraid of everybody.
Again, we're speaking to Karen Abbott, or Abbott if you like. She's speaking to us from the great beyond. And the name of her new book is The Ghosts of Eden Park, The Bootleg King, The Women Who Pursued Him, and The Murder That Shocked Jazz Age America. And as we've been discussing, the main characters include George Remus, who is this German immigrant from a poor, dysfunctional family. His father was an abusive alcoholic, so much so that George became the bootlegging king without ever personally drinking a drop of his own whiskey or anything else. Tell us a little bit about how he went from poverty to pharmacology to the law and on to building this illegal empire.
Well, he's a fascinating life story. And as you mentioned, his father was an abusive alcoholic, and the family came from Germany and settled in Chicago. And Remus had to quit school at age 14 because his father could no longer work and he had to help support the family. So he goes to work in an uncle's pharmacy. He quickly learns that trade. He buys his own pharmacy. Then he starts studying for law to pass the bar at night. He passes the bar. He becomes a very successful and notorious Chicago defense attorney. His courtroom antics became the stuff of legend. He would leap around the courtroom and tear at his hair and cry and scream and attack opposing counsel physically, you know, ended up in a pile of limbs on the floor. And people called him the weeping, crying Remus. It was sort of his persona. And he noticed that a new type of client began filling his docket in about 1920. It was these men who were charged with violating prohibition laws. And Remus was amazed with the ease with which they paid their fines. They would just throw down a few hundred dollars and be on their way. And Remus knew he was much smarter than these men and that he had a chance to clean up. So using his pharmaceutical background and his legal background, he scoured the Volstead Act for a loophole, and he found one, which was that it was legal to manufacture, buy, sell alcohol for quote-unquote medicinal purposes, which of course nobody was using alcohol for medicinal purposes, and Remus knew that and decided to take full advantage of it and created a really elaborate plan to do so.
Yeah, and one of the things, we're coming up on the first break, but I did want to ask you, from the way you tell the story, it sounds like during Prohibition, the government didn't get rid of all the alcohol, they seized the alcohol, so some of it could still be procured. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, you understand it correctly. They put it in warehouses and distilleries all across the country. It was pre-Prohibition bonded whiskey, and Remus moved to Cincinnati because 80% of the country's pre-Prohibition bonded whiskey was in a 300-mile radius of the city. So he knew that the alcohol was there. He just had to figure out a way to get it.
There you go. That is the voice of Karen Abbott. She is the author of The Ghosts of Eden Park. It is not closing time. We'll be back with more on Prohibition, George Remus, and his pursuers. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is Karen Abbott. She is the author of the new book, The Ghosts of Eden Park, The Bootleg King, The Women Who Pursued Him, and The Murder That Shocked Jazz Age America. She will be in Charlotte as part of Verse and Vino on November 7th. You can get more details about that at our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Karen, we were going through some of the histrionics of George Remus in the courtroom, but I wanted you to maybe set the tone a little bit, give people a flavor of what this book is like, and you were gracious enough to agree to read a little bit from that, so I'll let you do that right now.
Okay. So this is from the first chapter, which is called All the Rope He Wants. The house seemed out of a Bavarian fairy tale, rambling and turreted, laced with gingerbread cornicing and columns arched like sharp, imperious brows. It was the finest house in Price Hill, the finest neighborhood in Cincinnati, perched high above the Ohio River in its basin of residence and commerce, the downtown business district, the black families in the West End, and the German immigrants in Over the Rhine, where Prohibition forced breweries to sell root beer in the hope of surviving the law. Already, Remus envisioned what his dream palace would become. A Roman garden, a baseball field, a heated pool, a library stocked with books, presidential biographies, the epic poems of Homer and Milton, tomes of mythology and obscure science that would testify to the surprising depths of his mind. In this house, he would once again become someone new, a superior version of himself. In this house, the world would come to know his name. George Remus would be 44 years old that November of 1920, and he had spent the first half of his life gathering momentum for the second. He was the embodiment of the new decade, a harbinger of its grandest excesses and darkest delusions. He endeavored to become the best in the country at his chosen profession, a profession that could not have flourished so dramatically in any other era, nor become so swiftly obsolete. As America reinvented itself, Remus would do the same, living in rabid service to his own creation, protecting it at all costs. The cornerstone of this creation, the fulcrum that would allow him to pivot and rise, was Augusta Imogene Remus, formerly Augusta Imogene Holmes. Imogene, as she preferred, was 35, with dark hair and eyes and a voluptuous figure better suited to the bustles and billowing sleeves of decades past. They'd met 5 years earlier at his office in downtown Chicago, where Remus had been one of the city's preeminent defense attorneys and Imogene a dust girl, sweeping the floors and tidying his desk. She'd confided in him about her divorce, which had been plodding along painfully for years as she and her husband separated 10 times before finally going to court. Remus could commiserate. He, too, had suffered marital strife. Lillian, his wife and the mother of his teenage daughter, Romola, once filed for divorce charging cruelty, pure malice, and a habit of coming home early in the morning. They had subsequently reconciled, but their union remained tenuous. Imogene saw her chance.
And there's the cliffhanger. Thank you for that. So George Remus and his second wife, Imogene, moved to Cincinnati. They hatched this plot to get into the bootlegging business. And as you mentioned, they do really well, particularly with George masterminding this, and he controls 35% of the liquor market within a year.
Yeah.
And in 1921, he and Imogene decide to throw a little New Year's Eve bash. This is, as you describe it, just an unimaginable scene. Describe a little bit of what went on that evening as George and Imogene welcomed in the year 1922.
Yes. So just to give a little bit of context, George Remus is actually thought to be the inspiration for Jay Gatsby in F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Great Gatsby. And I think that his lavish parties were a big reason for this. So it's true, in December of 1921, he and Imogene decide to throw a fantastic New Year's Eve bash. They had aspirations to join the society and be well regarded by old money people and important people. And, you know, George was revealing his brand new mansion that he'd redecorated to the tune of $750,000, which was about $12 million in today's money. But the highlight of the party were the favors that he doled out. He gave diamond stick pins and engraved gold watches to the men. He gave a brand new 1922 car to every woman at the party. you know, like kind of like an early Oprah, you get a car, you get a car. He tucked a $1,000 bill under everybody's plate, which, just to give it perspective, is about if you and I went to a party today and found $14,000 underneath our dinner plate. And in a gesture that would be remembered with all decades later, he lit guest cigars with $100 bills. And this is an era when the average annual salary was about $1,300. And so it was just an obscene display of wealth. And Remus really thought that this was going to catapult him into society.
So let me go ahead and brace you. If you find $14,000 under your plate at the Vino and Verse dinner, you will have made history. that's thing one. Thing two is, how did the general population react to this? In other words, how publicly known were his excesses, particularly with that party?
Oh, they became very well known. And of course, some people were in awe. And I should say this, Remus had a big fan base in Cincinnati. There was a city filled with German immigrants. Many people had lost jobs with the onset of Prohibition, bartenders, glassmakers, barrel makers, transportation people. And Remus employed 3,500 people in Cincinnati, became one of the city's largest employers. So he was a sort of folk hero in Cincinnati. To the German immigrants and other newly arrived citizens. But there was a certain class of people, of course, who also were appalled by the fact that he was violating the law so blatantly and brazenly. And actually, it was this party that caused a Cincinnati resident to write to Mabel Willebrand and say, hey, you've got to check out the situation in Cincinnati. It's really egregious, and we need your help. And that's, of course, how Mabel Willebrand started to learn about George Remus and his empire.
So let's talk a little bit about Mabel. One of the things that is a theme through all of your books is not just rescuing history, but a lot of times you are rescuing extraordinary women. And certainly Mabel Willebrand would qualify for that category as well. So she came from a rough background. You write about how as a child she lived in a 9x12 tent out in, I think, the plains of Kansas. Very unusual to have a woman at that time rise to become Assistant Attorney General of the United States. And one of the reasons you write that she did climb to that level is because President Harding and others in the administration didn't really want to fight Prohibition, and they figured that this inexperienced young woman who didn't have a prosecutorial background would be able to do much with investigations or stopping illegal liquor trade. So how did she wind up becoming so effective at turning back a bootlegger like George Remus?
You know, Mabel was a fascinating character, and she was just made of steel. You know, as you said, she grew up in the Kansas Plains, very poor. But she, her parents really worked to shape her character and her intellect and to instill in her that she could do anything she put her mind to. Just to give you an idea of one factor of her upbringing, it's one of my favorite anecdotes about her life. Once she bit a pet cat's ear, and to teach her a lesson, her father bit her ear back. So it was just sort of this really hard scrabble childhood. And she really grew up believing that she could do anything she set her mind to. She was the first female. She worked pro bono in the Los Angeles court. She went to law school out there, worked pro bono cases with an exclusively female clientele, helping prostitutes and madams go straight. And she began making a name for herself. And President Warren Harding and Harry Dougherty decided that they needed to curry favor with the recently triumphant suffragists. And they wanted to put a woman in the job. And, it's important to say that when Mabel Willebrand was appointed to this position, women had only had the right to vote in this country for 9 months. Willebrand was only 32 years old, 5 years out of law school. And as you said, she had never prosecuted a single case in her career. And suddenly she was in charge of all of the prohibition cases across the country, thousands of them, into the tens of thousands by the end of her career, hundreds of thousands, many of them having to do with George Remus. And I think she was well aware that her bosses were not interested in fighting prohibition, and it just made her more determined to win.
So this is hard to imagine, of course, in contemporary America, but there was some dysfunction in the administration at this time a century ago. And President Harding, for example, was a fan of liquor and entertained in the private quarters of the White House with cocktails on a frequent basis. The Attorney General, who was Willebrand's boss, was on the take. And as you outline in the book, almost everyone, it seems like, in law enforcement was turning the other way and maybe getting a little compensation for doing so. All of which is to ask you, how difficult was this for Willebrand and the handful of people who were trying to enforce what was then the law?
Oh, her job was nearly impossible, and she was well aware of the challenges. One of the challenges was, of course, politics. Her bosses were not interested in helping her out. Many of them were actually in business with George Remus. and the other problem was America's geography. We have a porous border, 1,800 miles of coastline, a very porous border. There were airplane fleets of alcohol coming in from Mexico to Texas and from Canada to the Michigan Peninsula under the guide of searchlights every night. It was a very coordinated effort. And on an individual level, people had very ingenious ways of smuggling alcohol any way they could figure out a place to put it. There are some of my favorite ones I talk about in the book. Women were shoving alcohol in false rubber breasts. They were war veterans who were double amputees who were hiding alcohol in their prosthetic limbs. There were something called the Four Swallows. If you look this up, it's really fascinating. It masqueraded as a book titled The Four Swallows by J.B. Korn, which was a not very subtle reference to John Barleycorn. And it looks like a book, but of course, if you flip open the top, four vials pop up that you could, fill with any whiskey of your choice, hence the Four Swallows. And just people found a way to, there were liquor submarines rising and lowering out of sight in Long Island. There were just all various kinds of ways to smuggle alcohol. And there were many funny cartoons about Willebrand and the futility of her job. There was one called Give the Little Girl a Hand, depicting her with a broom trying to find trying to fight an ocean of alcohol back with a simple broom.
That is the voice of Karen Abbott. She is the author of The Ghosts of Eden Park, and she will be in Charlotte on November 7th as part of Verse and Vino. Details at wfae.org/charlottetalks. I want to go back to George Remus for just a moment. You were going through the trajectory of his life, and you mentioned his theatrics as an attorney. One of the best examples in the book that you describe is when he has a case in which a man is accused of killing his wife, and near the end, George goes over and picks up a bottle of poison and drinks it to the bottom in front of the jury and everyone else, and he survives. How did he pull that off?
Oh, it was such a great scene, and just so typical of Remus. It really really shows you a glimpse of his personality. So he drank this bottle of poison. Everybody in the jury gasped, and the courtroom spectators all were horrified. They were expecting him to drop dead. But George Remus, drawing on his pharmaceutical background, drank an elixir that neutralized the poison before he did this. So it was, in fact, a bottle of poison, but he had been able to neutralize it and survived. And everybody then, of course, acquitted his client, even though he was very guilty.
One of the running themes through this book is whether George Remus is sane or not. What conclusion or guess do you come to?
Oh, it's a fascinating question. It could actually be its own book, George Remus's Psychology. I believe that George Remus was sane, but I also think that he was nuts, if you can make a distinction between that. He was sane, but he knew, but he couldn't help himself. I think that that's the best way to put it. He knew everything he was doing, but he just could not stop himself. You know, there's all sorts of tangents we could follow with that, but his psychology was one of the interesting things in the book, and the fact that everybody in the book was dealing with deception. They were deceiving themselves, they were deceiving others, and everybody is haunted by something in this book, hence the title.
Yeah, did you come away liking any of the characters? They're all fascinating, but did you come away liking any of the characters?
I think that Mabel Willenbrandt is a hero. Just another thing to add, the fascinating fact about her to add to her difficulties in enforcing and performing her job. She was almost nearly deaf, which I write about in the book. You know, she spent an hour each morning putting on her hearing aids and then fashioning her hairstyle to conceal her hearing aids so that her male colleagues weren't aware that she was also working under that handicap, in addition to just being a woman in a high government position at that time. And I just thought she was an incredibly strong woman and fascinating. And I also ended up liking George Remus. I think that he was a very complex character and somebody who really embodied the 1920s. I do not think George Remus or this story could have existed in any other decade but the 1920s. And it really, he just really embodies that fascinating, dynamic period of American history.
That's Karen Abbott. She's the author of The Ghosts of Eden Park. Stay with us. We'll have more with Karen coming up next on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest is Karen Abbott. She is the author of The Ghosts of Eden Park, The Bootleg King, The Women Who Pursued Him, and The Murder That Shocked Jazz Age America. She will be in Charlotte as part of the Verse and Vino event on November 7th. Go to wfae.org/Charlotte Talks for more information on that. I wanted to pick up on some of the cameos in this book. There are all kinds of notable people who come in and out alongside the main protagonist we've been talking about. One of them is J. Edgar Hoover, who, of course, would lead the FBI for many, many years. When this case begins, he is just starting his career, and over the course of George Remus's adventures, J. Edgar Hoover will eventually be running the Bureau of Investigation and negotiating in a way with Willebrandt about how far to pursue some of the other threads of this investigation. So I'm wondering, at what point did you realize that all these other notable names still remembered today would be part of your story?
Well, I love that J. Edgar Hoover was just sort of, I called him Baby Edgar when I was writing this book. And I love the idea of Mabel Willenbrandt being in charge of him. She was actually the one who suggested he be promoted to become the director of the Bureau of Investigation, which was the precursor to the FBI. And Hoover, I should say, is actually one of the good guys in this book.
That's unusual.
Yes. He was very determined to have an honest force of prohibition agents. So his part really comes into play when he decides that Willebrandt's greatest detective, her ace of detectives, as she called him, Franklin Dodge, was having an affair with George Remus's wife, Imogene, and doing all sorts of nefarious things, stealing Remus's property, taking his whiskey certificates, endeavoring to do a bunch of illegal activities related to prohibition. And he did not like the idea that one of his agents was behaving this way and really wanted to go after Franklin Dodge and see exactly what he was up to with Remus's wife. So that forms the love triangle in the book. There was a very sordid love triangle.
Yeah, and I was going to say, without giving away too much, part of the tension here is that Mabel Willebrand does not want to pursue, or she doesn't want the information about her ace investigator going public as she's trying to prosecute George Remus. And so she is very hesitant to let J. Edgar Hoover go on with his investigation, but a little bit in J. Edgar Hoover fashion, he carries on anyway.
Yeah, Hoover ignores Willebrand. Willebrand knew that if it got out that her best agent was actually a crook himself, it would reflect poorly on her. She would be the one that would take the brunt of that criticism. But Hoover decided to continue his investigation. He sent one of his own agents to spy on Dodge. And this agent found all sorts of problematic behavior, including Dodge and Imogene were stealing Remus's whiskey certificates. And at one point, in a scene that was really a lot of fun to write, Hoover's agent catches Dodge literally with his pants down in a hotel room with Imogene Remus. And it was just sort of, you can imagine it was very shocking stuff back then.
Yeah, that's a bad day at work. I wanted to ask you a little bit. You read the portion of the book that describes the mansion that George and Imogene had in Cincinnati. It has since been razed, but there is a period in the book where George Remus is in prison. And as you say, the ace investigator and George Remus's wife are not only absconding with his fortune, they're also literally cleaning out the house. So,
yeah.
How was that chronicled, if at all, at the time? In other words, was it publicly known that all of this was going on while George Remus was in prison?
Well, there were certain people who knew. Remus had some confidants who sort of tried to hint to him that Imogene was not exactly what she was portraying herself to be. You know, Imogene had these nicknames for Remus. She called him Daddy. She loved her daddy. She wanted to please her daddy. When Remus was in prison, by the way, Remus went to prison because Franklin Dodge put him there. So to add insult to injury, the guy who put him in prison was now having an affair with his wife. And people tried to warn Remus about Imogene, but I think that Remus had blinders on. He truly cared for Imogene, and he did not want to believe that his beloved Imogene could be so deceptive as to start sleeping with the very agent who put him in jail.
Yeah, that could drive a person crazy, maybe.
Yeah, it could.
I mentioned, each of your books to one degree or another delves into unknown or forgotten women who did these surprising and extraordinary things. You mentioned earlier your book about the four women who were spies during the Civil War. What eras of history have you not explored that you would like to?
Oh, the Gilded Age would be one of them. I'm fascinated by the Gilded Age. I think there's so many similarities with today. My first book, Sin in the Second City, tells the story of a brothel starting in 1900. So it just sort of misses that period. So I'd really be interested in that. I'm also interested in the Great Depression and how people were innovative during that time and the feeling of wanting to escape that. But really the truth is I follow the story. If a story takes place in the 1980s that I'm really interested in, I'll do that. And I guess the 1980s is actually considered history, frighteningly
Ouch.
Enough. Now.
That hurt. That wasn't nice.
Yeah. Oh, it hurts me too. So,
in terms of, as I said, you put the spotlight, even though George Remus is a large character in this book, a lot of your books, rescue these stories from forgotten women. Is that something that you go into books wanting to do, or is it just whatever you find that happens to be interesting?
Well, it's a little bit of both. When I was in school, we studied history. I don't remember reading a lot about women's contributions and fascinating and strong women throughout history. And it just so happened that my first book featured two prominent, strong, interesting, mysterious women. And then it sort of became a more conscious interest for me. And, you know, with Mabel Willenbrand, she was not only powerful, you know, she at one point was the most famous woman in the country in the 1920s, except for silent movie stars like Clara Bow. And it was just sort of astounding to me that her name is just completely forgotten today. And it brings me not a small amount of pleasure to resurrect women like this and maybe introduce them to a new generation of people.
Yeah. Speaking of her fame, I wanted to highlight in the book, you mention a lot of the attention she received. There were all these profiles from reporters all over the country. And of course, some of them are flattering. Some of them are patronizing. And one that really stood out to me was from the Atlanta Journal. And I'm just going to read this quote to you and get your reaction. They wrote, the reporter wrote, quote, "Take a long look at the hand of the Assistant Attorney General of the United States. Never have we seen a hand which expressed more energy, common sense, and intelligence." What do they mean by that?
Well, I think that quote comes from a larger piece about Willenbrand's. She was interested in palmistry. So she studied palm reading, and she often read the palms of colleagues and friends. In fact, there's a scene in the book where she takes the hand of Harry Dougherty, her boss,
yes,
the Attorney General of the United States, and she studies it, and she sees that he's going to have to resign. And sure enough, that comes to be true. And she was too afraid to tell him in that moment. But I think that's a reflection of that. But that's not to say every article written about Willenbrand comments on her physical appearance in one aspect or another.
Yes.
And she wrote often to her parents complaining about this treatment of her. She called it that girly stuff and talked about how much she hated it. And she wished they could just focus on her activities, what she was doing in her work, instead of her appearance.
I know you spoke to some descendants of some of the people who were involved in these events. I'm wondering whether you spoke to any of Mabel Willenbrand's or if you've heard from them since the book has been published.
Oh, no, nobody from Mabel. I don't believe her daughter had any children. So the and by the way, her daughter, she adopted a daughter, so she became a single mom in the 1920s, which is also sort of astounding and progressive and interesting. But I have heard from nobody on Mabel's side. I have spoken quite a bit to people who were involved with George Remus's operation, the descendants of those men. In particular, the Gerum family, who were in charge of Death Valley, which was Remus's storage facility, just about 10 miles outside of Cincinnati, which is its own fascinating story. But I spoke quite a bit to them, and they told me some interesting stories about Remus and some goings on with the rum runners and everybody who would come to Death Valley to buy Remus's liquor.
And didn't one of the first initial busts, it was disrupted in part by a misspelling of Gerum's name?
Yes, that's actually true. Prohibition agents came to Death Valley and they had a search warrant, but Gerum's name was misspelled. So everything they collected at Death Valley became inadmissible in court because of that technicality. So just, you know, parts of the interesting legal wranglings that happened between Remus and Prohibition agents.
See, spelling counts, kids. That's the voice of Karen Abbott. She is the author of the new book, The Ghosts of Eden Park. She will be in Charlotte on November 7th as part of Vino in Verse. For details, go to wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Cincinnati itself, because it's kind of a character in the book as well. How much time did you spend there? How much cognizance is there in contemporary Cincinnati about all of these wild adventures that took place there?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people in Cincinnati had heard of George Remus just in a very vague general sense. Oh, we had George Remus. He was a big bootlegger, but they don't know his story and how interesting and fascinating he was and the sheer intelligence he used to become, you know, at some point George Remus's empire was estimated to be between $20 and $40 million. And that's not adjusted for inflation. That's in 1921. Which is just astounding. And so there's some awareness of him, but he, you know, has been largely lost to history as well. And I spent quite a bit of time there. There are some really great historical societies where I found artifacts from his parties. There was the picture of the engraved watch. There were firsthand accounts of people who attended that party and talked about how at one point Remus jumped in the pool with his tux on and how Imogene performed this perfectly graceful dive in a daring one-piece suit and just how everybody felt when the new cars were rolled out. So really great firsthand accounts, which are the lifeblood of narrative nonfiction. You need those primary source materials of people who actually witnessed the events and knew the people that you're writing about.
Let me ask a really dumb question. They may have all been dumb, but this one's really dumb, which is, so they have this New Year's Eve party, December 31st, 1921. And as you mentioned, one of the crowning moments is the pool and people jump in. Was this a heated pool, I assume, because we're in Cincinnati in December?
It was actually an indoor pool. It had its own building, but it was indeed a heated pool. It was christened the Imogene Baths in his wife's honor. And it even had electric baths, which I had to look up what electric baths were, but it seems that they were an early version of a tanning bed. They were heated by incandescent lights and said to make the user frisky. So that was also a big feature. And of course, just unheard of in 1921. You're in this heated a tanning bed that's going to get you in the mood.
I think we'll leave it there before we get ourselves in trouble. Karen Abbott, thank you so much. Really enjoyed the book and enjoyed the hour.
Thanks, Eric. I did as well.
That's Karen Abbott. She's the author of The Ghosts of Eden Park, and she will be in Charlotte on November 7th. More details at wfae.org/charlottetalks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Thanks for joining us today.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.